It's the 9th of August, 2025. Today is the Lunar Observance Day and also Saturday evening. Sometimes these evenings coincide with each other, two in one. It's normally at a bike area. We have a Dhamma event or a Dhamma talk on Saturday and then also on the Lunar Observance Days. Sometimes the Lunar Observance Day is on the Sunday. Sometimes the Lunar Observance Day is on a Friday, so you get a kind of a double hitter there, but then sometimes it coincides. So it's the full moon this evening. And during the Vasa period, which runs from the full moon of July to the full moon of October, which is the monsoon season in Southeast Asia, is the Vasa or the rains residence. So we observe that here, even though it's not the rainy season here. We observe it in terms of our rules. In particular, we become eligible for katina cloth offerings in the month following the end of the Vasa period. It's called katina season. So we follow a number of the rules in the Vasa. We don't leave for more than 6 nights. And we can't leave longer than that, so the community is more stable during this time. And in all Theravada Buddhist countries, we'll be observing this rains residence, this Vasa. It's a big deal for the Theravada tradition. And also on the new moon and full moon days, then the bhikkhus recite their Patimokkha. So there'll be there's a Patimokkha chanter, and then everybody else listens to the recitation of the Pali Patimokkha, the 227 precepts recited in Pali. And here at Abhayagiri, there are a number of bhikkhus who can chant that. So it's chanted in fairly rapid-fire Pali. It's roughly 13,000 words in Pali, chanted in a period, depending on the speed of the chanter, between 35 and 45 minutes. And then there's a checker, so if there's even a single mistake made, then the checker will catch it and the chanter will have to back up to the mistake and rechant that part of it. So this is since the time of the Buddha, this has been happening every 2 weeks. So it's just the world over. And all of our branch monasteries will have, in different parts of the world, will have been chanting the Patimokkha. So there's really a feeling of this sense of keeping precepts, trying to purify our conduct or behavior, and that this type of purity is encircling the world. It has a benefit, has an effect. As Winnie the Pooh would say, it's a something, it's not a nothing. So it has an effect, and not to belittle our own goodness. That's one of the reflections the Buddha gives us, is to recollect our own generosity, our own virtue, not in a way of becoming puffed up about one's generosity or virtue, but that to encourage oneself, to encourage the mind, and to energize the mind, brighten the mind. So there's this interplay between the monastic community and the lay community. And we were talking about tea time a little bit today, about the alms round and the receiving of alms food. And in our monasteries in Thailand, then it's the practice to go alms round every day. Also at Three Jewels in Fort Bragg, the town of Fort Bragg is close enough to our little branch monastery. They can go alms around every day as well. Pacific Hermitage almost every day up in White Salmon, Washington. So here we're a little bit too far away to go to the village for alms every day. Redwood Valley is 7 miles from here. So that can be done, but you would have to go and collect alms food and then probably eat on the way back. You wouldn't make it back before the noon cutoff time for the meal. So yeah, monks have done that before. But we go, we take the monastery vehicle in once a week. So that happened today as well, being the Lunar Observance Day. So every Lunar Observance Day, then there'll be a group of monks going into Ukiah, Redwood Valley, Fry Vineyards, places we've been invited to go on a weekly basis. So there's this interplay between the monastic community and the lay community. And then it's really, I find it quite lovely, because it's not just that we're really asking for food offerings so we can just live an easy life in the monastery and not have to work or have a career or anything like that. We, according to our precepts, we don't accept or use money. That's one of the reasons we don't drive. You'd have to buy gas. You'd have to use money somehow. But we're, it's not that we're just receiving food offerings so we can take it easy, kind of have an early retirement, just live peacefully in the forest, and just kind of expect that things will accrue to us just because we've come here. But there is a catch. There is a catch. You don't get, we don't have this relationship without doing our part. And that part is certainly the precepts and the renunciation. So this sense of renunciation, the bowl and robes, you could say that that's our license to receive offerings. And there's a pre-training for that. There's the 1 year of Anagarika, 1 year of being a novice before being eligible for bhikkhu ordination here to Bayagiri. So, but this interplay is very lovely because actually not everybody can live the path of renunciation. It's not easy, and it's not necessarily the best path for everybody. It's not necessarily the best that if everybody ordained, then everything would be great. That's not necessarily the case. It's dependent on people's spiritual faculties and paramis, and in some cases, it may be better for individuals to not ordain and to do good work in the world. That's going to be up to an individual's paramis and spiritual perfections. And this is when Longpo Cha visited the Seattle area in 1979. And I remember a past retreat, 2 weeks solitary retreat I was doing at a bike here. I was listening to Longpo Cha talks in Thai. And I listened to this recording. I remember it was June 9th, 1979. And friends of ours in Seattle, they still live in this same house, actually. That was kind of a pilgrimage site for us. And there's this tape recording of Ajahn Chah. They gave a meal offering at this house, and then we're able to have some Dhamma discussion, Q&A with Ajahn Chah after the meal. And there was some Thai people there, and there was one man who was kind of starting to, he'd been in the West for a while, and he was very scientific-minded, so he was questioning these ideas that about ordination and what's the big deal about all these precepts and things. And he asked Ajahn Chah, he said, well, what if everybody ordained? What would happen? You know, when things would just, society would just fall apart. And Ajahn Chah said, that's not going to happen. And he said, well, what if it did? What if it did happen? And Ajahn Chah said, you're like an earthworm worried that the earth's going to run out. You're like an earthworm eating earth, and you're afraid the earth's going to run out. It's like, it's always going to be a minority. It's always going to be a very, very small section of society who chooses the path of renunciation. The reason for that is it's difficult. It's difficult to give up sense desire. So it's difficult to pursue the path of looking for relinquishing the lesser happiness and seeking a higher happiness, because to do that, there is a period where we relinquish the lesser happiness and we don't have the higher happiness yet. So that's where our patient endurance or Kanti Parami will be tested. And that's what will really make or break whether this lifestyle is really for somebody. Can we get through that period, which is can be quite long, again, depending on our paramis, depending on our whatever accumulated virtues and qualities we already have in terms of our spiritual practice. That period can be quite long where we have to endure, where we've relinquished, say, what we call the Amisa Sukha, which is the literally means happiness of the flesh, and to try to pursue the Niramisa Sukha, which is the transcendent happiness or the happiness not of the flesh, the happiness of the blameless mind that comes from Sila Samadhipanya, virtue, mental cultivation, and wisdom and discernment. So, and also in saying this, I have to couch it in the terms of there's no judgment. There's no judgment in these teachings. The Buddha never judged people for pursuing the lives they pursue, he actually praised in many places householders who raised families righteously and kept the five precepts, but lived the lives of householders, as it says in the suttas, still tied by the five cords of sensual pleasure. And he didn't actually criticize it. He said, if they do good works, follow virtue, raising families righteously, that's good. That's praiseworthy. So the Buddha doesn't judge for the lifestyles we choose. He's not saying, well, the monks are better than the lay people, or people who hold these precepts are better than people who don't hold those precepts. But what he's saying is, this is the path to happiness. This is the path to suffering. So if you do this and this and this, then your suffering will decrease. And if you do this and this and this and the other thing, your suffering will increase. So the Buddha is just laying it out there. And the teaching has no judgment in it. It's more about, this is the path to happiness. These other things lead to suffering. You decide. It's up to you. You can decide how you want to live your life. And even to the point where sometimes on the monks who didn't yet have that much wisdom, they would actually, in the time of the Buddha, they would be judgmental of people, and the Buddha would say, he would say, no, don't do that, because you don't see that this person has this or that good quality. You aren't seeing the whole picture. So there's for example, there's a story of Sarakani the Sakyan, who he became an alcoholic, and he's from the Buddha's homeland, and he was a follower of the Buddha for a while, but then for some reason or another, he became very, very far gone alcoholic. They knew him as Sarakani who turned to drink in the suttas. And so then it occurs that he passes away, and we don't know how he passed away, but he passes away. He's the village drunk and he passes away. And the monks kind of, when somebody would pass away, sometimes it would be a tradition for the monks to go to the Buddha and say, oh, where is such and such reborn? Can you declare to us where they were reborn? What was their destination after they passed away? So the monks are kind of like, haha, I wonder where he was reborn. And they go to the Buddha and they're like, Lord, Sarakani, who turned to drink, has passed away. Where was he reborn? And they're kind of, you can imagine chuckling about it and kind of elbowing each other a bit. And the Buddha says, do not criticize him, monks. Sarakani was wise. And they're like, what? What are you talking about? Sarakani had faith in the Blessed One. And at the time of his death, he recollected Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and he attained stream entry at the time of his death. And he is headed for full liberation, not more than 7 more lifetimes. So not to judge things on the surface, well, they're not keeping the 5 precepts. So even then, it's you never know. You never know. So to be very unassuming. So coming back to this interplay with the alms round between the lay community and the monastic community, it is kind of amazing because it's a mode of practice that the Buddha sets up. And the Buddha himself chose to be a monk in his own path of seeking liberation. He chose to live as a monk, and after his liberation, he chose to remain living as a monk. That is significant. And he chose to remain living by the alms round, living on the donations of others. But then for people who the path of renunciation isn't for them, or don't feel like they're ready for it, there still is a path of practice, and that's through generosity, learning how to relinquish. And through that, then we can develop our paramis. Through that, we can develop our spiritual qualities. Generosity is really a beginning point of the path where we learn how to give up things. We learn how to, as the Buddha would say, give not with a closed fist, but give with an open hand. And we learn how to be generous, not just with the monastics in terms of giving alms, but we learn how to be generous with each other. And so this interplay, the monks being available to as an object of generosity, the bowl is that symbol of generosity. And so when we walk on alms round, say in Ukiah, and people come and give alms food, they're not giving to us as individuals necessarily, but they're giving to the Sangha, they're giving to Buddhism, they're supporting the religion and thus supporting their own practice. And that brightens the mind. People keep doing it. If generosity didn't have any good effect, then the group who gathers at Safeway every week in Ukiah wouldn't keep doing it. They would, you know, if they gave alms food and it felt awful to do, they wouldn't do it again. They wouldn't keep doing it. But because it feels good, and people keep coming back, people keep wanting to cultivate that generosity, it feels good to do that. And it links people with the monastic sangha. So if people don't feel like they can, or they're maybe not ready to join the sangha, then there is that link, because then they have a share. They've given a share and they have a share. They've gotten involved with the sangha through that generosity, gotten involved with the sangha through supporting the sangha. And through that, then there's that link, and then there's a part of the extended family, part of the extended group. So there's these relationships, these ways to be a part of what's happening here just through the alms round. And that's the wider sangha. So when we pay respects to the sangha, or we chant our praises to the sangha like we did this evening in Pali, then it's the four pairs, the eight types of noble beings. And that's the called the Savaka Sangha, or the Sangha of those who have come to wisdom, developed wisdom. We don't bow to the ordained Sangha, but we bow to those, they may or may not be ordained, may or may not be lay people, but those who have attained to wisdom, those who have attained the four stages of awakening. The Buddha recognizes those can be monastics or lay people. And there's many cases in the suttas of lay people who were anagamis, achieved the third stage of awakening, and even cases where they gave teachings to the monks. So there's this, the Buddha is only intent on people attaining awakening. He's not, if for an individual ordination is the best path for them, then so be it. Let them ordain. If for a certain individual being a layperson is the best path for them, so be it. Let them follow that path and do as good as they can. One of the blessings of being in the Sangha, one of the greatest blessings I've experienced, is actually being able to meet people, great beings, both monastic and lay people. And I've had experiences where I've met really stand-up lay people, both in Thailand and in America and elsewhere, all the world over, actually. There's really great lay people all over the world, whether it's India, Thailand, Bhutan, Burma. Been to these places, meeting lay people who are extremely impressive and have a very, very strong practice. I remember staying at the residence of a layman in Thailand, and he's a plastic surgeon who specializes in fixing cleft palate, which is a problem that a lot of children in more poor areas, especially in the north of Thailand, have. And part of his practice is big part of his practice is he organizes royal katinas in Thailand, but also is part of the Ajahn Mahabua community, and actually is very well off as a surgeon. So has a lot of funds that he uses to donate to the Sangha. But he also donates his time to going to these poor villages in the north of Thailand and fixing the cleft palates of these young children for free. So he just goes and does it as dana, but very quiet about it, and also very quiet about his own good qualities. So very, very humble. And I was super impressed by this. And he also, using his own funds, built an entire monastery and then offered it to the Ajahn Mahabua Sangha to make merit for his mother. And then after he offered it, he ordained as a monk temporarily for 3 months and spent the Vasa in this monastery. And so built a monastery, offered it, and then ordained and lived in it for 3 months. And he's kind of, I was going to the airport and going back to the Northeast on some business or another. So he lives in Bangkok, but is in Bangkok for a while and staying at his place, and he's driving to the airport, and he's kind of said, you know, I got here kind of late, and you were around, you were kind of, I could see you were up. And I said, and now it's really early and you're taking me to the airport. And I said, how much do you sleep? And he said, I get plenty of sleep. I get enough sleep. And I kind of try to, you know, so you do this and that activity and this and that. And finally I got it out of him that he sleeps 2 hours a night. I thought, and he just sustains it. And, that is very impressive, but it wasn't like an ascetic practice or it wasn't necessarily intentional. It was just, there was so much merit and there was so much parami. That's what it became. He's doing good works 22 hours out of the day and he sleeps 2 hours a day. That's just what it is. So, hopefully he doesn't listen to this talk. He'd be upset with me. I won't say his name, but, just like a normal guy. Just very not like no errors at all. And that's just one example of, you know, many people I've met who have these types of qualities as lay people. So yeah, very, very impressive. And I thought, yeah, I can learn something from them. Or, you know, even these old farmer ladies who stay up all night at Wapananachat and Wapapong in the Northeast, they're so tough and they just come and meditate through the night with the Sangha. And us monks could definitely learn something from them about patient endurance and commitment. Some of them, they do it every week and they've been doing it for years, decades. They'll come and stay up through the night in meditation, sitting meditation, walking meditation, the elderly lay women and also lay men. So there's this really stalwart group of them who do this, and it's very impressive. So this... through this interplay, we both benefit. We don't just benefit from food offerings in terms of being able to eat and live another day. That is definitely a benefit, but we also learn from lay people who have cultivated very impressive qualities of humility and kindness and generosity and so on. So it goes both ways. They're just, you could think of being in robes or not being in robes as two different ways of practice. And the robes are seen as what we call an upaya, which is a skillful means, a skillful way to practice, depending on our temperament. And then, of course, you have the impressive monks, Lungpo Sumedho, Lungpo Liem. I mean, I feel like it's not really even polite to praise their qualities, because in praising somebody, sometimes you're implicitly putting yourself higher than them, like, who, you know, I'm someone who can praise them. So it might not even be polite, but just to say that it's a great blessing to be linked with such beings, or to be able to, like we hosted Lungpo Liem recently, to be able to host great beings like that is really rare in the world. And you don't need to really be around somebody like that for long to gain the benefit. It's like when Lungpo Cha, he said that Lungpo Mun was his most influential teacher, but he was only with Lungpo Mun for 3 days, and yet he considered him his main teacher. And yet those 3 days, in a short period of time, somebody who is sincere can really gain the benefit. So he really gained the benefit from Ajahn Mun. Ajahn Chah talked about having a dream after he was with Ajahn Mun. He was continuing his practice, and he had a dream one night where Ajahn Mun came to him and handed him a shimmering jewel. And then he said, "Here, take this and keep it safe for me." And then Ajahn Chah took it and held it to his heart. And then he woke up and his hands were like this. Oh, that's quite lovely. I think that's in the Stillness Flowing, the biography. So it's, just to give some encouragement to take note of these relationships, and that this is a wonderful thing that we're all doing here, and the practice is worth making much of. And Lungpo Dumrong and Lungpo Kun are two other disciples of Ajahn Chah who were visiting recently, and we went up to Seattle with them, partly to this holy site I was mentioning, and this house that Ajahn Chah had a meal at in 1979. And we stayed there, and the last day before they went back to Thailand, there was a teaching in Seattle, and Lungpo Dumrong, he kind of surprised me by, because I was translating. He said, this life that we're leading, and we have to, there's birth, there's old age, there's sickness, there's death. We have to experience these things, and you have to know that it's not a small thing. So I thought, oh, it's not a small thing. Okay. And he said, it's not a big thing either. It's just the way it is. We just have to accept it. So it's not a small thing, but it's also not a big thing. It's just ordinary. So, but then through seeing these ordinary truths, then that's how we practice. That's how we start to gain insight. Because these insights that we're seeking, the insight into impermanence and so on, it's not like we're trying to overlay something that isn't already there. We're actually trying to discern the way reality is, the way it actually is. And that's why these are such special truths and such special insights that truly lead to letting go, because they deal with things that are already there. It's not something where like you need to tell yourself that everything is impermanent until your mind becomes enlightened. That's not the case. It's the mind really truly seeing it and seeing reality as it is. So these things are just ordinary and they're right in front of us, but they're too close. That's the reason we don't see it. It's too close. We think we might need to study it in a book, study the suttas and so on. And all in the meantime, it is what we are. It's just too close. We are. The Dhamma is what we are. We're the living truth of the Buddhist teachings, but then it's just too much who and what we are. It's too close. I won't say it's too easy because it's not easy, but it's too apparent here and now. So we're constantly overlooking it. So it is, it's not a small thing. It's not a big thing. It's just ordinary, but it is great to start to take note of these things. So with that, I think that's probably enough for the time period given for this evening. So wish everybody well, and I'll leave it at that.